Information, please. Presented each week at this time by Canada Dry, famous the world over for its fine beverages. Wake up, America. Time to stop the experts and enjoy a glass of refreshing Canada Dry ginger ale. Every week at this time, Canada Dry supplies four experts extraordinary for you to make sport with. You supply the questions, and if you're able to stump these wise men, well, it's a fine day for you. Let me tell you how it's done. You may submit from one to three questions with the correct answers. For every question we use, whether or not it's answered correctly, the sender gets $5. And if your question stumps our board of experts, you not only get $10 more, but in addition, you receive a complete 24-volume set of the current Encyclopedia Britannica. Mind you, this is only if your question stumps the board of experts. Our editorial staff may reword your question a trifle. Don't worry about it. Whenever there is a duplication of questions, Information Please uses the one that was submitted first. All questions become the property of Information Please and should be addressed to Canada Dry, 1 Pershing Square, New York City, or if you live in Canada, Canada Dry, Toronto. And now may I present our master of ceremonies, Mr. Clifton Fadiman, literary critic of the New Yorker magazine. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, Information Please is still the same spontaneous and completely unrehearsed program it has always been. The experts never see or hear any of these questions before you do. Tonight, we have our two regular metal giants with us. John Sheeran, the sports authority whose amazing memory almost never lets him or us down. And Franklin T. Adams, the conductor of the Conning Tower in the New York Post, who's an expert in so many unrelated fields that we can always count on him for plenty of help. Our two guests this evening are first, Christopher Morley, whom you've met before on other Information Please broadcasts, and whose new novel, Kitty Foyle, continues to hold its place on top of the bestseller list. Our second guest is a violinist and composer who is famous the world over and who needs no further introduction, Mr. Albert Spaulding. To our listeners, we say, remember, for each question that's missed, Canada Dry rings up $10. And that's paid out to the sender, plus 24 volumes of the latest edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, we're off with a question which is off the record, gentlemen, so that if you muff it, you shall have the thrilling experience of not losing $10 and not losing 24 volumes of the Encyclopedia. This question is as follows. Can you identify the famous American musician and the American political figure who was his superior officer when both were members of the same flying squadron aboard, abroad? Gentlemen? Is that question clear? Does this recall nothing to you, Mr. Spaulding?
Repeat the question, please.
Can you identify the famous American musician and the American political figure who was his superior officer when both were members of the same flying squadron abroad?
It's easy to identify the political figure.
Yes, who was that?
That was Gerardo LaGuardia,
yes,
President of New York. And his subordinate officer was a man who was trying to be a musician.
At that
myself.
Time. Mr. Albert Spaulding, yes. Both of you have done rather well for yourself since then, Mr. Spaulding, may I say.
Well, we're not complaining.
No, I realize that. Well, there is our off-the-record question, which starts us off. Now, the first real and genuine question, coming from Mr. W. H. Nudd of Yonkers, New York, is this. It's almost Christmas time. Most of you have, I hope, completed your Christmas shopping. Don't forget to mail early, gentlemen. You have made up a Christmas list, let us say, consisting of four items. And these items are perfume, cigars, candy, and a red kimono. Now, I'm not asking you to tell me for whom these various objects are designated, particularly the red kimono. But what I shall ask you to do is to quote a line of poetry in which you would find each of them. For example, the word perfume, you'd find in what line of poetry? Any line of poetry that you can think of. And by the way, this is not easy. Mr. Spaulding, are you going to give us one?
Yes.
All right.
The sleepwalking scene in Lady Macbeth.
That's quite right.
All the perfumes of Arabia will not wash this little spot away.
That's almost exactly correct, Mr. Spaulding. We'll not sweeten this little hand.
We'll not sweeten this little hand.
Very good indeed.
I remember it's not what it should be.
That's very good, Mr. Spaulding. How did you happen to remember that? What I mean is, how did you happen to remember it when Mr. Sheeran didn't? Matter of fact, I think there are remarkably few lines, well-known lines in English poetry that have the word perfume in them. That's one of the very, very few.
Faint perfume. Is never it? One fair lady.
Are you just thinking aloud, Mr. Adams? Just thinking aloud.
Not even thinking. Just emotion.
Well, we're all set on perfume. Now, how about cigar or cigars? Miss Kieran had his hand up first.
A woman is only a woman, but a good cigar is a smoke. Rudyard Kipling.
You say that with the most solid satisfaction, Miss Kieran. Mr. Moore, do you have another one on your mind?
I'm sorry, it was the same one.
Same one. Are you both married or both cigar smokers?
We both smoke the same cigar.
Oh, there you go. Mr. Spalding?
Yes, smoke gets in my eyes.
That's all right, but you couldn't give smoke away as a gift. It's cigars themselves that I'm after. Now, how about candy? Line of poetry in which the word candy appears. Or a line of verse, Mr. Adams.
Hippity hop to the barbershop to get a stick of candy.
That sounds very pretty. What's that from, Mr. Adams?
I don't know. Turkey rhyme.
It's all right with me. Mr. Morley?
It isn't precise, but there's a line in the Eves of Agnes about loosened syrups and candied cinnamon.
Yeah, candied used as an adjective there. Well, if you could send an adjective through the mail, that would be all right, Mr.
You can send the cinnamon through the
mail. You can indeed. Mr. Kieran?
Come along, my Mandy, sweet as sugar candy.
Hey, that's good. That's awfully good. And there's a famous admonition by the humorous poet Ogden Nash, which is a good thing to remember at times. Candy is dandy, but liquor is quicker. We're all right on perfume, cigars, and candy. Now, gentlemen, a red kimono. A line of poetry in which a red kimono figures or appears. This is not easy. Matter of fact, I think there's only one line of poetry in all of English literature in which it does appear. Would you like me to give it to you on a silver platter as a Christmas present and charge you $10 for it?
Well, Barbara Frietchie was wearing sort of an equivalent of it.
Mr. Morley, what was the equivalent?
Well,
that's a red. Was it final night?
It was an overnight garment.
Overnight garment. Yes, sort of a nightcap, I think. Wasn't it something of that sort? I've forgotten. I just cannot visualize Miss Frietchie at this moment. The lines that I have in mind are from Frankie and Johnny. Frankie went back to the hotel. She didn't go there for fun, because under her long red kimono, she toted a .44 gun. And I think those are the only lines with red kimono figures.
No wonder she done him wrong.
We were supposed to get 3 out of 4 on that, and we did. Now, the next question from D. Lesser of Detroit, Michigan, is about Mr. Spalding's colleagues, violinists. What violinists are suggested by the following pieces? There are 3 of them. All right, let's have the first. Oh, Mr. Spalding had his hand up after the second note, and Mr. Adams had his hand up after the sixth note. Would you like to give Mr. Adams a chance, Mr. Spalding, to tell us the correct answer?
Yes, Mr. Adams.
All right, that's very generous. Fritz Kreisler playing what composition?
One of his own.
Well, it's all right for you to plug it on the air. What's it called, Mr. Adams? Mr. Spalding?
Caprice d'Enois.
Yes, Caprice d'Enois. Very well. Shall we have the second? Mr. Spalding had his hand up almost immediately. Mr. Spalding?
Well, the piece is Schubert's Ave Maria, and it's very closely identified with Misha Erman.
Is it really?
Yes.
Much more closely, for example, than with Yasha Heifetz?
Well, Misha preceded Yasha by nearly 10 years in this country.
Yes, I'll accept that. So I think it is associated perhaps with either of those two famous violin of them. Very good. And now the third and last of them. Mr. Spalding, remember that you have to give us not only the name of that composition, but the violinist associated with it.
The name of that composition is The Bee, and it is by François Schubert, not to be confused with Franz.
We never would confuse
him. No. And the violinist is Jack Benny.
Why, Mr. Spalding. Well, I thought that'd be a sure stumper for you, Mr. Spalding. And how do you rate Mr. Benny?
I've never had the pleasure of hearing him play, so I can't rate him. It's merely his great reputation that I know that he
has. It has preceded him. That's quite true. Very good. 3 out of 3. The question answered mainly by Mr. Spalding, with some expert assistance from Mr. Adams.
Great assistance.
The next question comes from Park Cummings of Westport, Connecticut.
Mr. Cummings wants you to name three stories or novels, the titles of which include postal terms. For example, The Scarlet Letter would be one by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Now, any other terms used in the business of running the post office? Mr. Moore.
The Purloined Letter by Edgar Allan Poe.
Very good. And that's, of course, about a 10% steal from my hint, Mr. Morley.
Yes,
I'll accept it. Now, shall we get away from letters? There are many other terms connected with the post office. For instance, A Stoop to Farley by Ellen Glasgow might be one of them. I don't know what to think of that offhand. Let's have another, though. Something Simon Cure. Any term connected with the post office? I'll accept letter again if we have to. What? Gentlemen. At the season of the year, your minds should be preoccupied with the post office. Well, now, let me start you off with another. The Postman Always Rings Twice by James King, a bestseller a couple of years ago, would, I think, be a pretty good one. How about that? With the Night Mail by Kipling. Oh, I don't know. By Special Delivery, a short story by L. Henry. Gentlemen, I'm afraid we have to stump you on that. $10, please. Going to Mr. Cummings, courtesy of Canada Dry. Shall I give you a few more, just for the fun of it? RFD by Charles Allen Smart. A very good book of about 2 years ago. And Eugene O'Neill once wrote a little play called In the Zone. That might get by. Here's another question from Chief Thompson of Philadelphia. Now, gentlemen, there were five ships that were involved in the Graf Spee incident that you've all been reading about, not including the Graf Spee itself. I want you to name, or Mr. Thompson does, four out of these five ships. If you've been reading the papers carefully, you should be able to do this. Four out of the five. Now, you can collaborate on this if you will. Mr. Kieran had his hand up first.
I'll give one.
All right, one will start us off.
The Exeter.
The Exeter, which was one of the English cruisers, of course. Mr. Morley, were you going to help us out with another?
Well, the Ark Royal and the Renown were on the way there. I don't know whether they
I don't think I'd include them. Mr. Kieran.
I think another one was the Somerset.
What is the Somerset? What was its position in the incident? What part did it play?
It's an English boat.
Yes?
Well, it was one of the other cruisers.
No, it was not.
It was the one that was running away then from the Graf Spee.
Well, we don't want to include it in the incident then if it was running away from it. The Exeter is the only one so far that I think is quite correct. What were the names of the other two English cruisers? Now, that story has been running on the front pages for 5 or 6 days now, and these names have been constantly before our eyes. Sorry, gentlemen. Shall I help you? Miss Adams, did you have an inspiration? The Achilles and the Ajax were the other two English cruisers. The Exeter, the Achilles, and the Ajax. Now, what was the name of the German supply ship that took the sailors off the Graf Spee? Mr. Kira.
Tacoma.
The Tacoma, yes. And then finally, what were these English cruisers, the Exeter, the Achilles, and the Ajax, doing? What was their function? They were convoy ships, weren't they? And what other ship were they convoying, Mr. Kieran?
I think that was my Somerset.
No, it's the Formosa. French passenger liner that was being convoyed from Rio to Montevideo. Well, I think that's a brilliant failure, gentlemen. That will lose us $10, courtesy of Canada Dry, going out to Mr. Thompson.
But we see nothing they say, miss.
Now, that incident is practically over, gentlemen. You need not repair your morning papers any longer. The next question from Mr. Thomas D. Rhines of Glastonbury, Connecticut, is about fires. Now, suppose the fire department got a call to put out the following fires of literature, fires that you'll find in various novels and essays and stories. Where would the fire department go? For example, if it were a fire in a private art gallery, it would go to England and put out the fire in the picture gallery in Mr. Forsyth's house. You'll find that incident in Swan Song, John Galbraith's novel. Now, suppose there was an epidemic of fires for culinary purposes. An epidemic of fires for culinary purposes, Mr. Morley.
Charles Lamb's essay on roast pig.
That's quite right. Where would the fire department go to put out that fire?
China.
Do you explain in a well-chosen sentence of one of those...
Bobo was a greedy Chinaman who found by accident that when his pig was burned up in the back house, it tasted very good.
Yes.
And the only way they could think of to get more of those pigs to burn down the barns was the pigs in them.
That's quite right, yes. And it's the subject of the charming essay by Charles Lamb, dissertation on roast pig. Now, if there were a fire in a ship's hold, where would the fire department have to go? It's the very famous Mr. Morley again, an expert on fire.
Joseph Conrad's youth.
Joseph Conrad's youth, yes. And where would the fire
the
be
ship
taking
place? Judea.
That's right.
On her way to the Far East.
Yes, that's quite right. From where? What port?
Bombay, I think, but possibly London.
Well, between England and Bangkok, I think. Well, that's exactly right, Mr. Morley. You might be called a... I wish the Greek were at my the tip of my tongue the way it is the tip of yours. But what would a lover of literary fires be in Greek, these stories, Mr. Morley? I'll give you 20 minutes to make it up.
No, a pyrophile.
A pyrophile, lover of fires. Good enough. Now, suppose the fire department got a call to put out a false alarm. There was a false alarm in the living room. Wasn't a real fire, but a false alarm in the living room. Mr. Morley again, our renowned pyrophile.
You embarrass me. It was
not at all. I see. I don't.
It was one of the Sherlock Holmes stories. It was in the home of Irene Adler.
Yes.
A scandal in Bohemia.
That's quite right. And that would therefore be in what city?
In London.
In London. Yes.
As a matter of fact, it was in St. John's Wood, just north of Regent's Park.
What street? So three out of three, good enough. Now, up to this point, ladies and gentlemen, our experts have muffed twice, costing Canada Dry $20 and two sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And now Mr. Milton Cross, who never muffed, has a word for you.
At this time of year, shopping lists are usually filled with popular suggestions for every member of the family. And we hope that most lists include Canada Dry ginger ale and sparkling Canada Dry water. For this is the season when friends frequently come to call, and of course, refreshments are in order. And what could be more fitting to these lively occasions than these sparkling and lively beverages? For Canada Dry, the champagne of ginger ale is a delicious drink that supplies quick energy, refreshes inwardly, aids digestion, or in a word, it's gingivating. While sparkling Canada Dry water is the perfect club soda that adds flavor and life and blends well with your favorite drink. So remember, order them to be served at home and call for them when you are dining out.
Mr. Cross, that's excellent advice and delivered in precisely 47 seconds.
Sounds like Santa Cross.
Oh, thank you, Adam. We'll start the second half of the program with a question coming to us from Mrs. Charles H. White of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Now, this question is about characters in literature who were unaware of some important fact. This is a rather difficult question. I'll ask you to follow me closely. You have to get two out of three on it. What fact was unknown to the hermit of Copmanhurst when he entertained the Black Knight at supper? Apparently, this does not faze Mr. Kieran in the least. Mr. Kieran.
He didn't know that the Black Sluggard or the Black Knight was King Richard the Lionhearted.
That's quite right. From what book, Mr.
That
Kieran?
Is from Ivanhoe.
Mr. Morley had his hand up, too, I should say. Mr. Morley, is that right?
Yes, I was wondering if Ivanhoe, how often it comes in on this program.
Well, it comes in every once in a while. You know, we all had it in high school. We were all told to read it at any rate.
John ought to know it pretty well by this time.
I know it by heart.
Luckily. How about this one? This is much more difficult. What fact was unknown to Gudule, G-U-D-U-L-E, the recluse, when she held Esmeralda, and why, Mr. Kieran, let me finish my sentence. When she held Esmeralda until the hangman should come to take her to the gibbet. Mr. Kieran.
She didn't know that Esmeralda, the gypsy dancer, was her own daughter.
Yes, and that's not from Ivanhoe, is it?
No, that's from Notre Dame de Paris by Victor Hugo.
What do you think of that, Mr. Morley? He knows that, too. He's good. What fact was unknown to Mr. Archibald Carlyle of East Lynn when he hired a nurse to take care of his child? You didn't have that in high school, Mr. Kieran. Mr. Spaulding.
He didn't know that the woman he hired was the mother of his child.
That's right, Mrs. Spaulding. That's quite right. How do you happen to remember that?
I don't know. I think I must have been told it maybe 100 years ago when I was a child.
Now, isn't it astonishing, Mrs. Spaulding, what this program does to bring things out in you?
Oh, yes. That's
quite right. She was the child's mother, his divorced wife in disguise. And you may remember, Mrs. Spaulding, that she finally removed her wig and he recognizes her. A very dramatic episode.
Did she remove her wig? Oh, what a pity.
Yes, it is. She had hair under it. Quite all right. Won't be horrified. We got three out of three on that. Mr. Spaulding and Mr. Kieran doing the hard work. The next question from A. Mills of Baltimore, Maryland, is a musical question.
We have a studio violinist here who's going to play three cadenzas written for famous violin concertos. I'm going to ask you to name the composer of each cadenza and the concerto for which it is written. Is that clear? Do all of you understand that? Very well. We'll have the first of them. Mr. Spaulding had his hand up almost immediately. Mr. Spaulding.
That is Fritz Kreisler's cadenza to the Beethoven concerto.
To the Beethoven concerto. All right, let's have the next. Mr. Spaulding again. Thank you, Mr. Spaulding.
That is Joseph Joachim's cadenza to the fourth concerto by Mozart in B major.
That is quite right. Quite right. Mr. Spaulding?
That is also Kreisler's cadenza to the Brahms concerto.
Is it Kreisler's cadenza? Are you sure?
Well, it resembles that, or it could be, that because the opening is very much like Joachim's cadenza also.
No, I'm afraid not.
Play it again.
Well, do you mind playing that again?
Once again. Oh.
Mr. Spaulding? Thank you, Mr.
Spaulding. Our cadenza.
Who is it?
Yes, our cadenza.
Yes, our cadenza. That's quite
our
right.
Our cadenza. It's a little confusing because all three cadenzas commence very much alike. It's only in the use of the B flat. The augmented thing.
Yes, I would say one before you try to explain that. Good enough. The man sure knows his cadenza. Very well. Here's a question from Mrs. M.J. Abribot of Washington, D.C. about fictional detectives. Mr. Spaulding, do you read detective stories?
Yes,
okay. Then you have to work for the next minute or two. Identify the following fictional detectives. The first one made an important deduction from the conflicting testimony of a Frenchman, a German, a Spaniard, a Hollander, and an Italian, Curran.
Monsieur Dupin.
Monsieur Dupin, in what story?
Murders in the Rue Morgue by Edgar Allan Poe.
Yes, and will you explain the situation?
Well, all these different persons reported hearing a man speaking in a foreign language to them. He thereupon concluded that it was a language that no man understood. Consequently, it was an animal, and it turned out to be a gorilla or an orang-utan.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Now, in this case, the fictional detective always solved his mystery, although he never saw the evidence nor the suspect. He never saw the evidence nor the suspect. Mr. Morley.
Sherlock Holmes' brother, Mycroft.
Now, how would you defend that answer? That's not the answer I have on the card.
Because whenever Sherlock Holmes was at a loss, he would report the information to Mycroft, who was malingering at the Diogenes Club in Pall Mall, and Mycroft always gave him the dope.
That sounds
purely
reasonable.
By intuition.
That sounds reasonable. The one I had in mind, though, is Max Carrados in the Ernest Brahma story. Mr. Morley, do you remember that?
He was blind.
He was blind, so he never could see the evidence or the suspect. Max Carrados in the Ernest Brahma story, the eyes of Max Carrados is the one that I remember. In this case, the detective would often change his appearance while shadowing a suspect by assuming the numerous disguises that he carried with him. And his pistols, as I remember, were fashioned in his sleeves in such a way that they pop into his hands when he raised his arms. Any idea? I'm glad to see that all of you gentlemen were well brought up. If you had been brought up as I was brought up, you would know the answer to the question. Mr. Morley?
Sounds like old sleuth.
Well, darn near.
Nick Carter.
Nick Carter, yes. Nick Carter, exactly right, Mr. Morley. You did get 2 out of 3 on that. Thank you very much. Now, see if you can do any... Are you gentlemen prepared for a spot of the bird call identification? The zoology department of Cornell University wants you to identify the birds from the calls you'll hear. I don't know how many we'll have time for. Let's have the first. That scratch is not a bird, Miss Karen. That's just something that we have on the machine. Mr. Morley?
I know that's the bird you hear about 5 o'clock in the morning, but John doesn't.
5 o'clock bird? I don't think
very early.
Any idea, Mr. Karen?
I'm a French idea. I never could tell birds off a phonograph.
That's a catching worm bird. I'll tell you. It's the red-eyed vireo. What is a red-eyed vireo, Mr.
Karen? Yeah, I know a red-eyed vireo very well, but I never would know it from that sound.
And what other kind of eyes do they have?
There's a white-eyed vireo, and a red-eyed vireo, and a Philadelphia vireo, and a yellow-throated vireo, and a solitary or blue-headed vireo.
What a family.
What's Johnny doing?
Right around here.
Shall we have another one of these bird calls, Mr. Adams? All right with you? Mr. Karen?
It sounds like a very thick and sore-throated yellow-breasted chat.
I think it's a very healthy brown thrasher.
Oh, have the third.
Can we have the third? How about that?
Take him away. He's breaking my heart.
Well, gentlemen, it's a loon. And the Zoology Department of Cornell University will get $10 plus, and they may need it, a 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Very well, gentlemen. Our experts, apparently, have failed three times, which means that Canada Dry has lost a total of $30 and three sets of the Encyclopedia. And now Mr. Cross tells me he's going to deliver a Christmas greeting from Canada Dry, and I'll be back with the lineup.
Well, friends, here once again is that holiday, that season of St. Nicholas, when we all enjoy the presents we get, whether useful or ridiculous. So Canada Dry has something to say, and we hope that you will bear with us. In fact, this is our Christmas card to those who've been on the air with us. To John Kieran, who can answer such questions as, what kind of birds lay what kind of eggs on the Crowany Isthmus? Canada Dry says, John, boy, Merry Christmas. To Franklin T. Adams, who can sing the score of The Pink Lady and who knows everything about the Floridola Girls, that is, everything within reason, we simply say, FPA, compliments of the season. To our musical friend Levant, who can play etudes, concertos, and even things like La Tosca, we would say, if he was with us tonight, greetings, Oscar. And to Clifton Fathaman, the incomparable, whose ready wit rules these experts so well, we say in French, which of course he speaks fluently, Joyeux Noël. And finally, to every listener on every radio station, Canada Dry sends greetings as lively and sparkling as pinpoint carbonation.
And a Merry Christmas. And a Merry Christmas from Canada Dry to you, Mr. Cross, and to you, Mr. Morley, and to you, Mr. Spaulding.